Hello, everybody. Welcome.
Hello. I am Rhonda Hull, and I'm an artist, an author, a speaker, an edgewalker, and a space holder for love, sometimes in the oddest places. And I am certain that love is the driving force and that death need not be seen as an enemy, but rather as a part of life that teaches us that joy is possible regardless of our circumstances and that every moment is precious, even the messy ones. So today I come together with a treasured friend. I've been looking forward to this opportunity to be with Reverend Simon DeVoyle. Simon is a unique individual who dares to share his many talents. He is a devoted Scottish interfaith, interspiritual minister, a sacred musician, youth worker, and wooden boat builder who uses his songs, reflections, carpentry, and caring as his soul's way of making sense of the beauty, vulnerability, and endless richness of this human life. Simon, one of my favorite testimonials about you is this one. Simon, your voice is so scratchy, but when I listen to it, it soothes me. Will you sing for me so that I can fall asleep? And that's from Eve, age 9.
Yeah,
so, she sums it up.
18 now.
Oh my gosh. Well, hopefully you still can sing lullabies and record them for her because they are just as useful now as they were when she was 9. So
she actually is a patron of mine now, which is just beautiful. And also, I know that she does quite a lot of stuff with my music on Spotify because she makes playlists. And it's interesting. The internet tells you a little bit about how people are using your music. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there, that soothing thing. Yeah, I think that's part. I think she put her finger on the pulse about what I do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I appreciate your willingness to dive into this conversation about making friends with death, because I know that death is a part of your ministry. And I know that you have really gained insights about death through death and through, you know, just the many transitional moments that happen from the time we're born until the time we pass from this human reality. Mm-hmm. And the topic of death is often a taboo topic that people aren't comfortable talking with. As you reflect back on when you were little, can you remember when that awareness that death was a part of life came into your knowing as a little kid?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I didn't grow up in America. So I want you to remember that my concept of death is a Scottish one in my childhood and my formation. And I was very aware of my ancestry as well, because it was something that we talked about a lot. And I remember on my 5th birthday, me and all the little girls that were there for my birthday party found a dead mouse. This is probably my earliest memory of death. And we buried it as part of my birthday party.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
When did you first experience the loss of someone close to you?
When I was 18 or 19, one of my friends from school committed suicide. Mm. And that was quite a waking up, because it was one of my peers. He wasn't my closest friend, but that was a bit of a intense thing. But the first big death was that impacted me was my grandmother when I was 21. And I still think about her. I still miss her terribly. She was called Roberta. Love her. I feel that she's my spirit guide, actually.
Yes. So
I feel very close to the dead. And I remember when she died. She was old and she had a series of strokes, and you know, it's a blessing sometimes when people die. And what can I tell you about that? There was almost an elation. I remember listening to a really whooshy, powerful song, and I wouldn't have any words for this at that time because I wasn't a spiritually minded person, but my soul could feel a movement out and a freedom, and it felt like a sunrise.
Uh-huh.
Even though I was in my grief, there was this exhilaration of energy outpouring. And I think that was the first time I became aware that death is an intense energetic portal, even though I didn't have any words to describe that. And that was when I was 21.
Right. Yeah, I know, too. It really, I've experienced it as true in visiting different places in Europe. There is, you just feel the history that goes back through so many generations that's reflected in the buildings and mm-hmm. and it's different than here in the States, which it just doesn't have the generational experiences that we can relate to in the same way as you can in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it makes a huge difference to many things. It changes your attitude to death. You feel the presence of the people who have been there more majestically.
Yeah.
And it's like almost more tangible. But also, I think it gives you a sense of belonging that I think some North Americans struggle with. I think that is something that many people who come to me as a chaplain are looking for, is a sense of belonging.
Yes, yes. My life has really taken me on this journey from womb to tomb, from being a birth doula and now finding myself often in some capacity as a death doula. But there are many, many births and deaths in between. So what I find as a constant in the birth experience is a constant in the death experience. And we think that we're afraid of death, but I think it's uncertainty that we're afraid of. And as we traveled through life, it's those transitional moments where we experience a death, but then something new emerges that carries mm-hmm. us through our life. And I know that you've had some really huge transitional moments in your life. I'm wondering if you'll speak to those and how they relate to your relationship with both birth and death.
Mm-hmm. Rites of passage are what you're hinting at here. And I think that birth and death are uniquely mirrors in a way that no other rite of passage is. Like if you think of a wedding or a coming of age, there is a process of dying to your old self. And that there's a grief, I think, that's similar, but they're an ultimate spiritual doorway into the infinite, I don't think is there in the same way. Like when I've been through my ordination or marriages or my gender change, in which, you know, I did some ritual stuff and I had surgery, which was a very big rite of passage. There might be a few people who are watching who don't know that I'm a transgender person. So I was born female, which is why there were all girls at my five-year birthday party. I've also lived in many countries. I lived in Australia and loved it and was devastated to leave. I lived in Scotland. I now live here. I'm about to move to Vermont. I have lots of stages of life where there's grief and loss and sorrow with that. And my gender change was very strongly, like losing my alto voice. I'm actually showing a film here on Crowdcast on the 9th of May that's all about the death of my alto voice. But I think that it's more the idea of the death in the rites of passage that is scary to us. There's not the same real loss of a person that you can no longer hold and you can no longer call them. You know, death or the arrival of a birth is so incarnate. You know, it's so bodily in a way that the other rites of passage aren't, even when you're changing your body.
Right, right.
You still continue on. You know, I still have the same body. It just looks different. Whereas when somebody dies, they die and they're gone. They're gone back to the invisible place.
Yeah, it's a bigger stretch to understand that that energy of that soul still exists. It's just not in the human form where you can relate to it in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I know of one experience in your life that was, you know, in just those birth and death experiences in between that first inhale and that last exhale, that to me is such a way of capturing one of those transitional moments that exists in this human experience, was the story of your guitar. Oh, so yes. I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about that, because it's...
Yeah, I mean, that's another example of where that rite of passage of losing my most expensive possession and one that I was so emotionally connected with, short term was huge, but then I ended up with a new guitar that I can touch and hold, and so there is a there's a happy ending there. So let me tell you about this. So I like to be super Simon and do too many things, and that day I was doing a baptism actually of a little baby who is a little girl now, Philomena, and it was the first baptism I'd ever done, and it was a bunch of singers. The parents are singers, and all the guests there were singers, and we were singing the baptism, which obviously makes it more spiritually profound, adds all that beauty to the prayer. And at one point we sang to Philomena, "Welcome, you've come from the stars." And she looked at me, this little baby who was 1 year old that day, looked at me with the oldest, wisest eyes, and it put me into a altered state that I never really recovered from. Yeah. So after the baptism, I go to the supermarket and buy some food to make soup because we're doing this concert that night to celebrate the Felicity Anne, which was a boat that had been rebuilt, the first boat to be solo womaned across the Atlantic. And it was cold, so I decided to make soup because I like to be super Simon and do too much. And I was distracted, so I was making soup and unpacking instruments, and just like this morning, there wasn't enough time. And I accidentally drove over my guitar with my truck, and my truck smashed it smithereens. And Lyndon was away, my wife was away that night, and I remember it being 5 a.m. I couldn't sleep. I was so upset about it. You know, I've played this guitar at people's deathbeds. I wrote my precious songs. It came out of the payment I got for making the movie, went into this guitar. That was my gift from that. And I remember in the middle of the night, I'm kind of upset and in that sleep-deprived state. And I got my pendulum out because I wanted it to tell me what to do. And of course, it didn't tell me what to do. So I threw the pendulum away. And then I was like, God, tell me what to do. And very quickly, a peace descended upon me. And I heard a very quiet thought in my mind. And it said, rebuild me as a sacred object. And, You know, the observation part of me suddenly woke up and was like, I think that was my guitar. It was a female voice, and I'm sure that was my guitar that just asked me to rebuild her. I've never heard my guitar before. I'd had it for like 15 years or something. And that's why I did. I learned how to do it. This is a new piece that I am a boat builder. So as you said, Rhonda, and I found a piece of a boat to put on here. And it sounds amazing. And it's a very resurrected guitar. It looks completely different, and it has a different voice, but the body of it is all the same. Uh-huh. Is that the story you were fishing for?
Yes. And it's where you've brought together, I mean, so many new gifts came out of coming to peace with the letting go of the old, so that this new could come into a new form.
And I think that Reverend Pam, that we both know and love dearly, she's been talking a lot about a new stage of grief, which is making meaning. And I think that you mentioned that to me too. And I think that's very true for this guitar. Now, when I play this guitar, well, first of all, I learned how to build instruments, and it was extremely difficult. So I'm aware of it in a much more heart-centered way, because I know the story about all the different pieces and the struggle, and I chose the rosette. It's a trinity, a Celtic trinity, and there's St. Francis on here covering up the old electric. So there's details of it which are heart-filled for me, but there's another aspect, which is I rebuilt this as a sacred object. So when I got the piece from the boat, In my mind, I spent about a month trying to connect with the tree that would have been cut down, a cedar tree, cut down in the 1970s or 80s here on the peninsula. It was old growth. And through that mystery of trying to work out, how the hell do you pray with a tree, you know? And it took me a long time to just get my mind out of the way enough to be able to feel the presence of this majestic old cedar tree. And now when I play, I feel that that blessing is co-created with me of the tree, and that I am very much a druid-inspired person. Druids are the people of the oaks. I'm a carpenter for a reason, because I love trees and wood, and it holds a strong medicine for me. And in my mind, I have the ally of the cedar tree when I am playing my guitar, and that's why I don't let other people play it. I have one of the things I did was I bought a second good guitar in case anybody asks, and I also, when I put the guitar away, I wrap it in this red cloth that I was given by a Native American elder. It was the first vestment I got. I had to wear it around my head when I was doing a ceremony. And that my guitar wears that, and I do that to remind me that this is a sacred object and not just a musical object.
Right.
And I believe in all that stuff. I think that allows me to pray with the universe, co-create rather than just create myself.
Right, right.
That's a really long answer.
So many people. We all come to that awareness of, or our assessment of the divine from so many different facets. And some people are allergic to traditional religious doctrine. Some people feel you can't have a connection to spirit or the divine without it. Mm-hmm. Spirituality kind of became a bristly word for some, as some transition from religion to spirituality. Like, do you have to abandon your religious beliefs in order to be a spiritual person? And I looked at the word sacred, and in meditation one day, and recognized, like, if you just jiggle the letters around, it's that movement from scared to sacred. You know, mm-hmm. you same letters in create different words. So, mm-hmm. how is it that you hold your spiritual ministry in a way that serves, because the way that I've experienced you is you serve so many who may not hold the same beliefs as you. How do you help juggle between scared and sacred, especially now when we're all thrown into kind of an uncertain time?
I think one of the gifts of being a transgender person is that I'm less frightened of change. I also, as a divorced person, when the worst happened to me, I did not choose to get divorced, you know? so that those two big things were not eventualities I would have chosen if they hadn't been my soul truth. If I could have not been trans 20 years ago, I would have signed up for that. But I knew, just like with sexuality, you can't change the way your nature is. It's who you are. It's always been there since, you know, like ever since my first memories, I realized I was more like a boy. And so I think I am a little bit less frightened of change than other people.
Yeah.
And I really believe that any security that we have is a complete illusion. You know, the phone can ring and you can hear that a person is dead and everything has changed.
Right.
Your life forevermore, right? You know, part of the work that I do sometimes is with people that are widows or parents that have lost adult children, which is just so painful. It's so painful when a child dies. It's just not the way it should be. And it changes a person forever. And I don't know whether, because I was a boy that wasn't parented as a boy, and there's a bunch of families where they've lost sons and I end up in the mix, and and I love these parents so, so much. They're like my parents in some ways. There's a strange connection there. And maybe I'm overthinking it, but a very important part of my life for me, and it's not just my ministry, my soul life is companioning people through grief as they, and grief brought me to the sacred. It's what brought me to my knees enough to have to breathe in the power held in the earth, because me as an ego person was struggling. You know, that 12 steps place where you hit rock bottom and your ego, you have this ego death. And a lot of that for me was about grief. But you were asking about scared and sacred. Yeah, I've made that dyslexic mistake a few times and people have fired back and said, did you know you said scared instead of sacred? Or you said sacred instead of scared? It's usually the latter. I don't know. I don't feel that fear. Maybe it's because I didn't grow up religious. My parents didn't install a religion in me. They're big old agnostics. And my dad's a bit more complicated than that, but they taught me to be very critical of organized religion. So I personally don't have a barrier. And I believe that diversity is where life thrives, like the rainforest or a garden. And I specifically love the metaphor of the garden, because the garden isn't as special if you take the gardener out. I used to think that humans were a bit of a mistake for the rest of life, but we're not. If you've ever been to a Japanese Zen garden and felt the peace in there, oh my God, what a wonderful way to respond to creation with a garden that is deeply sacred and cared for.
You said that, is it grief that brought you to deciding to become an ordained minister, or what led you to make that choice?
Well, my experience, I think this is because I'm a songwriter, right? So my soul is a big voice in me. Time is not linear to me in the way that it is to everybody else. And maybe that's because I have premonitions or whatever. But when I was on Iona in 2006, I met a young South African minister called Lauren. She was amazing. I remember her doing a sermon on Winnie the Pooh and honey. Anyway, she was broke my concept of who ministers were. She was younger than me. She was just badass. And she said to me, Simon, would you think about being a minister? And I said, no way, because I don't believe that there's only one religion. I think they're all valid. And she said, that's the whole reason you should be a minister. That is not a barrier to ministry. That is the green light. And that sowed a seed. And then 2 years later, towards the end of my time on Iona, I felt really called. I felt a calling and from the sacred mystery to be a minister in a new way that didn't exist yet. And then when I lost my life on Iona, when that came to an end and my marriage ended, nothing else other than my spirituality and the grief story and making sense of that, making meaning, was alive in me. And my connection with the sacred just became so strong when my emotional bonds and stuff with people were gone, and community, it really switched that on to God as the beloved. And I heard James Finley, he's a wonderful Christian teacher, talking about Thomas Merton's, when his mother died as a young child, and then when he was 14, his father died, and that longing for the sacred parent, whereas for me, longing for the sacred beloved brought me directly to a reciprocal longing relationship with God. And that's rock solid. And I really feel like it was my grief that brought me to there.
Yes, yes.
And it took years for that connection to be more of a joyful one.
Right. Is it, you're a songwriter, an exquisite songwriter with the wonderful, soothing, scratchy voice. So how have you used your music? How have you found it to be valuable in ministering to someone who is getting ready to pass and as they are passing?
Well, it's a soul language that transcends other things. It's probably the most, I think the two things that you have when somebody is dying that are most valuable, or touch and song. Especially if somebody's unconscious, you have something to go and hold time and space for the loved ones to connect. And so, you know, like it was a year ago yesterday that Nancy Anna died, and we were there at her birth together. That was such a beautiful experience. And one of the things I got to give her upon her death was when people didn't, you know, some people were completely comfortable with Nancy Anna dying. Other people, it was deeply uncomfortable. And in that process, I was bold enough to offer her a gig. You know, you're gonna, in the last half hour of your life, because she chose death with dignity. So there was a specific time that she died. I was like, that's going to be really weird, that half hour. Do you want me to sing to you? And she was like, yeah. So I sang to her, but I also sang songs that everybody could join in and sing with her. And then when she became unconscious, the music, I believe, still connects with the person. There's prayer that is being evoked. There's energy that's being evoked. But it also gives the people who are witnessing something that they can join in with. They can hum along. They can listen. It fills a peace in the time and space when time and space are like falling away all too fast.
Right,
There's a lot of awkward silence around death for some people. Like you go and see somebody and they're unconscious and you hold their hand at the bedside and you don't know what to say. But
And the human sense that is last to go is the sense of hearing.
And that's what they say, yes. I'm getting so caught up in that story that I'm forgetting your question a little bit, but I do think that music is, I'm so grateful that I have music and that I've had to learn, you know, my job at Unity as a music director, part of what I do there is the music director. I've had to learn all sorts of songs that I wouldn't have bothered to learn for myself.
Uh-huh.
And that allows me to have a whole repertoire of prayers that are bigger than my own spirituality. And then I can try and find the right ones to give people as they're dying or as they're preparing for it. I've also, last year was a big year for me, and there was a young man with cancer in his brain, and I played music with him and visited him many times, and then did his memorial and green burial. And the music about life and death was able to allow us to have conversations that might have been much more difficult without it. Like at last time I played for him, I said, I have a song for your life and I have a song for your death. Because we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. And I played them both. And what was amazing was that his daughter, who was quite young, under 10, she was there too, and she helped hold the life one with me. Maybe she wasn't in the room when maybe I couched the language a little bit about death around her, but she knew her dad might die, you know, so, and he invited her into that process. But the music gave a way that we could, 9-year-old child, father, young father who's dying, and me connect in this moment of not knowing and bless it for whatever unfolds.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're all being stretched to expand our capacity to sit with the unknown. Mm-hmm. And what we resist, I mean, there's such richness there, but it is developing a relationship with that. And I think if you have a conversation about music, or you intuit a certain song for a person that reflects, this is for your life, this is for your death, that you're actually channeling what their religion is, you know, what their sense of spirituality is, because it's reflected through the music. And I know at Nancy Anna's passing, I remember you saying to her, I mean, I recorded your singing for her. And in listening back to them, it's so powerful to hear your wonderful, soothing, scratchy voice and to hear her breathing in the rhythm with your music. And you said to her, Nancy Anna, I have a kick-ass funeral dirge. Do you want to hear it?
And
because of who she was and her sense of humor, I mean, it was perfect. So I'm wondering if you would choose a couple of songs to share with us.
Absolutely. I thought you might say that, so I brought my enormous folder of songs here. Well, I think I have to. This is just crazy. This is not all the songs. This is not that. Maybe I'll sing that Kick-Ass Death song, and then I want to play the Horse in St. Columba that I wrote after or around the time that Nancy Anna was dying. I knew that she had moved into hospice because I was writing this song about St. Columba and a horse that came to visit him when he died. Yeah. And I was playing it on the grand piano at Unity, and I just knew. I was like, oh, this is time. It's Nancy Anna's time. I could feel her being like the horse, or me, whatever the magic was, coming to me to say, now is the time to go and be with her before she dies. And I felt that through the music. And it completely sabotaged my songwriting process because I was supposed to be setting Christine from Abbey of the Arts. I was supposed to be setting her poem to music. And I couldn't do it after that because my experience in the music was so much about my encounter with Nancy Anna, and I'd say that through the horse and St. Columba, and a lot of the language that she had around that legend wasn't true to my own experience. So there was less words needed. You know, death isn't about words. It's about eye contact and touch and breathing.
Yeah.
And just being together. You probably relate to that, huh?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It's holding the space.
Mm-hmm.
It's just holding the space.
Which is precious and finite. And there's nothing more profound than realizing that this is the last hour.
Yeah.
That this breath is going to stop soon. Like when you're watching somebody leave their body, it's tremendously, like with Nancy Anna, it was tremendously peaceful.
Right.
I remember that with my grandmother too, when she was losing consciousness, there was a great peace. And there was like a stress of her body that was lifted. Death brings gifts to people who are in pain and at the end of their life. Oh, I should have got this out beforehand. I should have foreseen that you were going to ask for this. So this is
while you're looking, you know, that the whole birth process, because I've been at so many births, these little people come in and you being present, you get to know this one's an old soul or this one's a new soul. I mean, you feel the different energy of these kids, and they've come through the portal to the light.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy on the other side is surrendering them to this life experience. They come in and we welcome them here, and the reverse pattern happens at the time of death, where we let them go and bless them, grieve them here, but they're back in that complete energy of love at the time of their passing. So it's quite a process.
It's such a mystery. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, who would have believed it? Nobody. But there it is, happening right in front of our eyes all the time.
Yeah.
I need to cull this. It might be in a different section. I might have. I've got a section of modern songs that really are better than hymns.
Yeah.
And I might have put it in there. And if not, then I'll have to sing one of my own songs.
Yeah. Then the divine is offering other guidance. You know, back
it is.
In the
I mean, that's one of the things I love about this folder is sometimes I can't find things. I'm like, okay, well, that's not the right song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here it is. When I Go by Dave Carter. So Dave Carter wrote this song shortly before he died. He died as a young man, and he received this song in a dream, which is pretty intense. And then recorded it with Tracy Grammer. And it's amazing. And this is the one that I said, hey, Nancy Anna, I've learned this kick-ass death song for you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't quite give myself enough space in this wee nook. I'm in the corner nook of my bedroom. Come, lonely hunter, chieftain and king, I will fly like the falcon when I go. Bear me, my sister, under your wing, I will strike, fell like lightning when I go. I will bellow like the thunder drum, invoke a storm of war, a twisted pillar spun of dust and blood up from the prairie floor. I will sweep all false before me like a gale out on the snow, and the wind will long recount the story of reverence and glory when I go. Spring spirit dancer, nimble and thin, I will leap like coyote when I go. Tireless entrancer, lend me your skin, and I will run like the grey wolf when I go. I will climb the rise at daybreak, I will kiss the sky at noon, raise my yearning voice at midnight to my mother in the moon. I will make the lay of long defeat and draw the chorus so. I'll send this message down the wire and hope that someone wise is listening when I go. And when the sun comes, and when the sun comes trumpeting from his red house in the east, he will find a standing stone where long I chanted my release. He will send his morning messenger to strike that hammer blow, and I will crumble down uncountable in showers of crimson rubies when I go. Sigh, mournful sister, whisper and turn, I will rattle like the dry leaves when I go. Stand in the mist where my fire used to burn, I will camp out on the night breeze when I go. And should you see my wandering form out on the borderline between death and resurrection and the council of the pine, do not worry for my comfort, do not sorrow for me so. All your diamond tears will rise up and adorn the sky beside me when you go. I will be right there beside you when I go.
So wonderful.
So, thank you, Rhonda. So you wonderful. Couldn't even hear it properly because you're listening through the phone. I am going to take a little second to attend to Crowdcast.
Yeah.
So, I'll bring you back. Yeah. So there's that one, and then I wanted to also play the Horse and St. Columba. I'm actually sitting at my piano. Oh, you won't be able to hear this at all, Rhonda.
I can hear it.
Okay. The horse sees him there, so frail on his way to Vespers. A clip-clop of hooves, he goes over to the old man, nuzzles on his shoulder. Columba bids him welcome, rests his head upon the horse, breathes in the scent of fur and field. My friend, everything must end, even this love, everything must end. They rest a moment there. The horse knows death is nigh. hoof scrapes the ground, and deer's bleat fall like rain. Everything must end, even this love, everything must end. They breathe in more deeply now. My friend, everything must end, even this love, everything must end. They rest a moment more. The monk resumes his day, cloak soaked with tears, he's on his way to Vespers. Hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. So beautiful. And I've just witnessed the power of your music, felt it myself and just witnessed it in so many ways. It's really, you've brought a huge blessing to my life with it.
Thank you. Thank you. I love that people use my music around healing and death and death ritual. It's the biggest honor. There's nothing more important than caring for somebody as they die or as they're birthed.
Yeah.
You know, I think birth is filled with danger and uncertainty in a way that death is a bit more inevitable.
Right.
But in right. both of those situations, both those tomb and womb portals, when people use my music, I am so incredibly humbled by that.
Well, I know that you have to plan to be around for a while, because I know so many people of varying ages who have requested that you be there to sing as they pass. So you have to.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. That's an with me moving.
Travel at light speed.
Yeah, I wondered whether to bring that up with the congregation about trying to get a slush fund for travel to come back. And
yes,
it's yes. That's one of the hard things about being a person that moves internationally, is that I can't necessarily be there. But the internet is doing amazing things. Let me just check the chat. Seems to be working. This is great. I'm using a new technology here. I have to move you around, Rhonda, to be able to read people's comments. But
fine.
apart from that, it's great. My screen isn't big enough. We have 45 minutes left, and I wondered if you wanted to ask anything, a different topic, or ask a bit more depth of anything, Rhonda?
Well, you know, in talking about the uncertainty, so many people right now who are faced with whether they're passing because of COVID-19 or some other reason, that it's limited the being able to have someone with you when you pass. And I know that your mother-in-law just passed, mm-hmm. and you were mm-hmm. unable to be with her. Yeah. So if you would speak about how to hold a presence even when you can't be present.
Well, that situation makes my soul weep, that people can't be there especially for the moment of death, and to say goodbye. I mean, we got to do Skype or FaceTime the day before Sally died. My mother-in-law, her name was Sally, and she wanted us both to be there. She must have known. She didn't die of COVID. She had dementia and got pneumonia, and she was lying on the couch, and her speech function was really altered. But we spoke to her, and she kind of said, yeah. And I told her I wanted to sing for her, and I sang her Amazing Grace, the first verse of Amazing Grace. And I said, Sally, you know that one, don't you? And she was like, yeah. And And we got to say, you know that we love you very, very much. But about a month before, we'd gone to visit her and I got to hold her and I knew it was the last time I would see her. And at least I got that. But I'm very concerned about what war and the pandemic or any situation in which we can't attend to the dead properly. I think it's, I mean, I have quite strong views about souls aren't just gone from this world after they die. And my Native American teachers have often talked around their ancestors who were murdered, and there was nobody to, the living had to leave. And they were just left without any ritual, and how that haunts the land still. And I think things like genocide and places where they're like clawed in the battlefield, there's an imprint of that energy in the land. So I think it's first of all bad for the being of the earth, but I know for individuals it can be absolutely devastating not to be able to say goodbye. And I'm grateful that we have technology helping with this, but I've been trying to create a lot of resources exactly to companion people, and on my online group of people, which is mostly through Patreon.
Yeah, make sure you share how to reach you and how to learn more about your work.
Yeah, as soon as we finish with the video, I'll post something in the chat function. With my chants and prayers for healing, I invite people to say what they're praying about. But I also, a number of my patrons who, like, there's a wonderful woman in Nova Scotia who is holding that whole situation with the murders there, I'm trying to make resources available, sending people songs, and there's a bunch of stuff up on my website. I've got a page called Pandemic Prayers. On Good Friday, I did a specific ritual to honor a loved one when you weren't able to do that through a funeral. So I'm trying to create resources to help our souls do that at a distance, because I know from that FaceTime with my mother-in-law the day before she died, that made a huge difference to me. I think that music and stuff can companion our soul in the time of trying to make sense of death, where you don't have ability to come together and hold each other and grieve in the way that humans have for forever. The green burial I did in January, where we loaded the body in the ground and everybody put the earth back in. And it was so bodily. It was so much about community coming together. It's devastating to me that people don't have that. And also, like, my teachers in New York, they're being asked to serve the mass graves where bodies are not being claimed. You know, they're probably immigrants or the families are too frightened. This is important to me to try and bridge the gap, and I am stuck on the internet doing that. Luckily, our community, nobody has died in Jefferson County with this. The worst that we've had is the isolation and funerals being canceled and things like that. It makes me weep that people are not able to do the death rituals properly. And so many people don't do them anyway. I mean, what's wrong with America? We don't want to upset anybody. Let's not have a memorial.
Right. I think ritual has become elusive, and people have lost connection with how valuable it can be.
I think that we're not attending to our souls very well.
Well, I appreciate the gift that you have given so many today by your presence, by your music, by sharing at such depth. And I don't know how many seconds we have left, but I'd love to hear your final words, and then maybe you can just play us out.
I will do that, and I am very concerned that my audio is still working. There's something really strange happened with my computer. I'm going to not be concerned about audio not working. Can you ask your question again, Rhonda? Because I had a panic for a second that the live stream wasn't going.
It shows how when we stay in panic, all of our creativity completely shuts down.
I know, it's terrible. Our listening,
Yeah, I'm just so grateful for the gift that you've shared today. And I wanted to know if you had any final words you wanted to close with, and if you just wanted to play us out in our last few seconds.
I think my closing word is that death is completely natural. Freya, my dog, who's barking, agrees. Yeah, death is
it's a part of life.
It's part of life. It's a great adventure, and it, but also it's completely devastating. All the things.
Yeah.
Deep peace of the running wave to you. Deep peace of the flowing air to you. Deep peace of the quiet earth to you. Deep peace of the shining stars to you. Deep peace of the child of peace to you. And moon and stars pour their healing light on you. La 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 la. La 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 la. Amen. Rhonda, thank you so much for asking to do this with me.
Oh, such a pleasure. Such a deep pleasure.
And
yeah.
Then all the people online who, I don't know how many there are, I need to move Rhonda for a second. Oh, 13 people online right now. Thank you for watching and listening to us, thinking that what we have to say matters, that I'm really grateful to everybody who made this happen. Do you have any last words of wisdom, my friend? I mean, you're talking to me as if I'm the one that holds the wisdom, but that's that is not true.
I feel it is the same, that death is a natural part of life. And if we attune our ears to hear it, it invites us to live more fully in every moment. And, you know, I worked with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross years ago, did training with her. And as she outlined the five stages of death, they've revised it to being the five stages of grief, and they've added that sixth step. A wonderful man named David Kessler, who's an amazing grief counselor, added the step of meaning. And so to me, it really is what fills my soul, is knowing that there's a meaning that may be a mystery still, but that it matters.
Thank you, everybody. And be well. Love to you in these uncertain times.
Yes.